You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 8th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. It's 1500 in Seoul, 9 a.m. in Gaza, 8 a.m. here at Dufourstrasse 90 in Zurich, and 2 a.m. in Baltimore. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Globalist starts now. Live from Dufourstrasse 90 in Zurich, this is The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. A very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up.
Here's the current reality in Gaza. Despite important steps that Israel's taken to allow assistance into Gaza, the results on the ground are woefully insufficient and unacceptable.
6 months on from the start of the Israel-Hamas war, we examine the new nature of conflict, regional, unpredictable, and testing the limits of long-standing allies. Also coming up, Russia makes moves to overrun Ukrainian defences before more Western aid arrives. We'll have the latest on a weekend of fierce resistance to Moscow's offensive. We'll ask whether China will use artificial intelligence to disrupt elections in the US, and we'll take a look inside One World's first dedicated lounge in Europe.
I believe that the kind of classic thing that an airport lounge wants to have is, of course, the tarmac view and the contact with the nostalgia of flying and going somewhere else, right?
And we have not only one, but two paper reviews today, one from Midori House in London and one here in Zurich. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from Zurich. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Iraq says it will send 10 million litres of fuel to the Gaza Strip to aid Palestinians. The head of the IAEA has condemned a drone strike on the Russian-controlled Zaporizhia power plant in Ukraine. And for the first time, French soldiers will conduct a changing of the guard outside Buckingham Palace in London today, with British soldiers doing the same duties in Paris. The move is part of a celebration of 120 years since the signing of the Entente Cordiale. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, 6 months ago, days after Hamas launched its brutal attacks on Israel, Israel's staunchest allies leapt to offer their support. The US and UK were some of the most vocal as retaliatory strikes were launched against Hamas in Gaza. But 6 months on, Israel's allies are beginning to ask serious questions about the way the country is waging its war, with more than 31,000 people killed in Gaza and huge sections of the population starving. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now by Nick Gowing, who's Distinguished Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London. A very good morning to you, Nick.
Good morning, Emma.
Let's just begin with the news that's broken in the last 24 hours. The idea that the reporting of Israel pulling back a lot of its troops from Gaza, from the south of the Strip, and now Palestinians going back to Khan Yunis, to what effectively is a city in ruins. What more can you tell us?
Well, I can't tell you much more apart from the fact that this has been announced, but I think there's something even more broad than just withdrawing from the south of Gaza. When you look at what Iran is now threatening against Israel following the attack on the embassy in Damascus, when a number of the Revolutionary Guards were killed, they have warned that there will be an attack on Israel. And my suspicion is that there's a reconfiguration of the Israeli forces going on, which is to reinforce the Northern Command up on the border with Lebanon because of what Hezbollah might be threatening to do. Remember as well that Iran has, over the weekend, has warned that it will attack Israeli diplomatic interests around the world. And my suspicion is at this moment that actually there's a reconfiguration and an assessment going on of, do we have enough forces to resist both Hamas in Gaza and continue our operation there, and also to act in the north of the country along the border with Lebanon? And there are limits to what the Israeli forces have at their disposal, because last week they cancelled all leave for the reservists.
And this is borne out by the fact that Israel's military has said that it is prepared for any Iranian threat. And you know, an Iranian official, as you mentioned, said over the weekend that Israel's embassies are no longer safe. I mean, before we even start to talk about what's happening in Gaza, you've introduced the idea that this is could be a war that people have been dreading, which is that it starts to spill over regionally into areas which are rather uncontrollable.
Well, it becomes a multi-front war. I mean, Israel will have calculated on this, but on the other hand, having taken the action against a diplomatic establishment in Damascus and violated the laws there, Iran is now considering very clearly what kind of action it can take. But if you listen to those who are analyzing Iran, including Iranians out of Tehran, there is certainly a feeling of Iran will not want to go too far. But that was based on the assumption of there being a kind of understanding between Hezbollah and Israel, even if they do have 150,000 missiles in Lebanon. But this is now escalated into something far more sinister, potentially, and Iran not wanting to go too far, even though they want retaliation for what happened in Damascus last week.
Let's focus on Gaza itself and the events of the last 6 months. I think we do need to go back to what happened on the 7th of October when 1,200 Israelis were killed and more than 250 were kidnapped. One cannot really underestimate the scale of Hamas's attack on Israel, can we? Because it effectively shattered Israel's sense of security.
It did, but that's history now. 6 months ago, we still don't know quite why all the signals of what was happening and what was being planned over 3 years just across the border, which was observed by members of the IDF, didn't actually make it to the National Security Council and therefore into the thinking of Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing cabinet. But I think we've moved on considerably since then. I'd just like to bring to your attention, Emma, an article in the Huff Post this morning where they have interviewed two members of Hamas. And they make it clear there is simply no way at all that they will do any kind of deal with Israel. They still want Israel wiped off the face of the earth. And so the deep-rooted horror of what happened on October the 7th is still very clear, which is that Hamas does not want to recognize Israel and they don't want a two-state solution either.
You mentioned now that this is history, but as we have seen in the last couple of days, at least in Israel, this is absolutely not history for the families of those taken hostage. And this is the fundamental issue that Benjamin Netanyahu is struggling to deal with. And to all intents and purposes, people are questioning his methods.
Of course, and that is something which is very much at the heart of domestic Israeli politics at the moment, particularly with the right-wing cabinet moving even further to the right. And Netanyahu in a survival mode because of all the other things which are building up on him. It seems quite obscene to think that actually Netanyahu is doing all this to avoid appearing in court on corruption charges. But that's the way it does look. And certainly with, I think, about 136 hostages, 135 hostages still unaccounted for. One who was, the body was released over the weekend, having been killed by Islamic Jihad in January. So in other words, that body had been there for at least 2 months. It shows the absolute absolute priority of Israel to do this. But I have to say, and this is a remarkable interview in the Huff Post this morning, they've interviewed two members of Hamas leadership in Qatar separately. I mean, they go into how they got the interviews and so on. And assuming that everything that they're reporting is right, and I have no way of corroborating it, of course, they're making it quite clear that there's no way that the hostages will be returned because that would be a weakness by Hamas.
Indeed, I think that the NZZ here in Switzerland has a visit to Khaled Mashal as well. That very much gives the impression that Hamas is publicly on the, you know, is happy to talk to the rest of the world.
Well, I'm not sure about happy to talk to the rest of the world. They don't tend to operate like that. They operate very covertly. But they have made clear, and they will have made their political decision on this basis. And this is in Qatar, as opposed to the military wing somewhere in the tunnels inside Gaza, that Hamas has no quarrel, I'm quoting here, with the Jewish people or Judaism broadly, instead opposing only aggressive actions fueled by Zionism. And that suggests Hamas would accept a Palestinian state limited to territories Israel did not control before 1967, aligning it with the idea of a two-state solution. My very strong reading on the diplomatic front is that essentially, even with the involvement of the CIA director Bill Burns in Cairo over the weekend, I don't think this is going anywhere, because Hamas and Israel are dug into very deeply entrenched positions. And ultimately, you only get some kind of movement towards peace when there's a certain kind of fatigue which has set in. And certainly, I don't read any kind of fatigue at all. And probably getting back to your question of 2 or 3 minutes ago about the withdrawal of some of the Israeli forces from the south of Gaza, this is about a reconfiguration and probably consolidation of forces so they are ready for anything that might happen, including on the northern front.
Nick, let's look at the way that the rest of the world has changed its approach to the war in Gaza. I mean, at the beginning of the programme, we heard Antony Blinken, US Secretary of State, saying the results on the ground are woefully insufficient and unacceptable when it comes to bringing aid into Gaza. And questions have started to be asked quite seriously, haven't they, about the way that Israel is conducting its operations, with the death toll, way over 30,000 now, as reported by the Hamas-led health authority in Gaza. But where does this leave global influence? Because the United States has come up short here, hasn't it? As has NATO.
Well, I wouldn't say they have.
Not NATO,
until
the United Nations.
I have to say they had until a few days ago. One has to imagine that the 30-minute conversation between Biden and Netanyahu a few days ago was pretty vicious. And you do get a sense that actually there has been an impact, certainly on the humanitarian side, within reason. But I do think that there is confusion still, and the signals are very clear about what happens with the recognition of international law. And this sense, and this is why David Cameron, Lord Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary, is under such pressure here to even go to the House of Commons, as opposed to being in the House of Lords, to explain the British position. Because there's no doubt, and this is made clear by the former National Security Advisor, Lord Sedwell, that it's really important that they set out what really boils down to is that it's unlawful in British law to export arms that would be used in breach of international law. In other words, other countries want to be seen to be complicit in the breaking of international law, not just the UK, but many other countries as well. And so this puts America in a far more complex position, particularly when it comes to the recognition of the international courts and so on.
And indeed, globally now, and we're hearing voices from the likes of Brazil saying new voices need to join the top table. There's a lack of global governance. Even the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said the current international system is devoid of fundamental concepts such as solidarity, justice and trust, and cannot fulfil even its minimum responsibilities. This is a war in a geographically small space, which has questioned every single global norm, hasn't it?
Well, I think it's worse than that. I've been working on a project since I left the BBC 10 years ago called Thinking the Unthinkable. And one of the things we've been saying for some time is that there's an unraveling of respect for international law. And I think this is a profound part of this. It's not just in the Middle East and what's happening in Gaza. It's what's happening in Ukraine as well. The fact is that many laws and many international agreements, which have been fought over for the last 70 years and emerged from the Second World War in 1945, they have been unpicked. They were being unpicked. They are now being literally two fingers are being put up at many of the international conventions and so on. And I think that is the really sinister thing that is emerging from this lack of respect for international agreements. And this is what is being put to the test in Gaza with Israel by the international community.
Nick Going, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist live from Zurich. 9:14 in Kyiv, 8:14 here at Duforstrasse 90. Now, the head of the IAEA has condemned a drone strike on the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia power plant in Ukraine. Reports suggest a building containing a reactor was damaged, but there was no risk. Well, joining us now to tell us more about that and the events of the weekend is Olga Tokariuk, a Ukrainian journalist and regular voice here on Monocle Radio. She joins us on the line from Kyiv. A very good morning to you, Olga. Delighted to hear you. If you could just bring us up to date, please, with the news emerging about the drone attacks on the Zaporizhzhia power plant, please.
Yes, exactly. So the head of International Atomic Agency, Rafael Grossi, said that there were three direct hits against the main reactor containment structure of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant that is controlled by Russian occupiers in Ukraine. This is very serious. He said that this happened for the first time since November 2022 and since he laid out five main principles how to avoid a serious nuclear incident with consequences that would be detrimental in terms of radioactive safety. So International Atomic Energy Agency said there was also one casualty. They said it has not compromised nuclear safety, but this is a serious incident. And Ukraine denies it is behind this drone attack. The representative of Ukrainian intelligence, Andriy Yusov, said that blamed Russia by saying that Russia resorted previously to these imitation attacks to later blame Ukraine. And actually, Ukraine doesn't really have an interest in damaging a nuclear power plant, which is on its territory that is now occupied by Russia, but Ukraine considers it its own territory. So Ukraine doesn't see the point of causing a nuclear incident there.
This power plant is effectively in the middle of this. It sort of symbolises the real core of the problem, doesn't it? Because it's been caught in the crossfire since the Russian invasion in 2022. It's being held by the Russians. If anything goes wrong there, then the consequences are catastrophic.
Yeah, well, absolutely, you know, and that's why, Ukraine will be the country and the people of Ukraine will be those worst hit if something happens. That's why Ukraine has absolutely no interest in causing damage to this nuclear power plant. Ukraine has a good memory, a vivid memory of Chernobyl nuclear catastrophe in 1986 when millions of people were affected. And then Russia, on the other hand, has a track record of hitting and damaging infrastructure objects. In recent weeks, it intensified its missile and drone attacks on Ukrainian energy infrastructure, basically destroying an energy power plant in Vinnytsia region and many other regions of Ukraine, causing significant damage to electricity supply in Kharkiv, depriving basically city of 1 million people of electricity for a long period of time. And that supply has not been restored yet, as Kharkiv continues to be under quite intense Russian missile and drone bombardment in recent days.
Olga, let's move more broadly as to the situation across Ukraine in the war. The commander of armed forces has said that Russian forces are advancing on the ground and that pushing them back is difficult. What does he mean by that? And where are the intensive points?
Yeah, well, the most intensive point at the moment is near Chasiv Yar. It is in Donetsk region. So after the loss of Bakhmut and Avdiivka, Ukrainian troops have been facing intense pressure further in the western part of Donetsk region. And there are concerns that Russians will try to capture Chasiv Yar and then move towards Slovyansk and Kramatorsk that have been, solid Ukrainian strongholds since 2014, after they were briefly taken by Russian forces in 2014. They were then recaptured and became centers of Donetsk region that is currently under Ukrainian control. Another potential line of attack could be Kharkiv. Kharkiv, as I said, is under a very intense Russian missile and drone bombardment. Every day there are casualties, there are killed people among civilians in Kharkiv because of these attacks. Kharkiv lacks sufficient air defense. And Ukrainian officials have been making a particular emphasis on the need to receive more air defense systems to protect Kharkiv. About 1 million people are still living there despite these bombardments. Russians at the moment seem to lack the capacity to capture the city, to conquer it. But they might resort to the tactics of Mariupol, you know, just like launching drones, missiles and aviation bombs on the city to cause huge damage to civilian objects, to infrastructure, to make the city unlivable.
Tell us a little bit more, therefore, about the growing need or the intensifying need for more military aid. I mean, we had President Volodymyr Zelensky over the weekend warning that Russia will win if the US Congress does not approve military aid. I mean, it seems a very direct appeal, doesn't it? And one wonders if there are any other solutions to this if this aid package is still stuck in Congress for some time.
Yeah, I think Ukrainian officials have become very blunt recently in their statements to convey the sense of urgency that is palpable here in Kyiv, here in Ukraine, that Ukraine needs these weapons urgently, otherwise the front line might just collapse. The aid package has been stuck in the US Congress for months already. There is no end in sight to when it could potentially be disbursed. We are seeing some efforts of European countries to step up to provide artillery shells that they promised to Ukraine, so there has been some progress in that, but this is not enough. Obviously, the US has the most potential, the most capacity to provide Ukraine with military assistance. Ukraine has been also trying to ramp up its domestic production, but it is mostly of drones that are hitting Russian oil facilities with the goal to deprive Russia of oil revenues to finance its war machine. But of course, Ukraine needs ammunition. It cannot attack, and this has been made clear by Ukrainian officials as well, that Ukraine does not have a capacity to counterattack. So the goal for this year is to hold the line, to not let Ukrainian defenses collapse. And for this, an urgent supply of ammunition is very important.
And what about not only the supply of ammunition, but the number of people who are able to join the war? That this reduction of the draft eligible age for men from 27 to 25, how's that been? What's been the reaction in Ukraine to this?
Well, this is something that has been long overdue. This changes to the mobilization legislation that have been discussed for months already. This law was supposed to be voted and approved by the president in January, but then there were some objections from MPs and, it dragged on. But finally, this changes were voted by the parliament and now assigned by the president. So this is something that had to be expected. And I spoke to some experts yesterday who told me that actually they think it was the Ukrainian authorities, they didn't really conduct a very successful mobilization campaign in the first 2 years of war, that there should have been more promo campaigns of recruitment. The time has been lost, actually, and also that this mobilization age lowering should have been done earlier. We'll see what impact it will have, but it is undeniable that Ukraine is facing the shortage of human resources as well as ammunition.
Olga Tokariuk, thank you so much for joining us on the line from Kyiv. Still to come on today's programme.
We wanted to introduce these local flavours to the design, and we were inspired, for example, by the bridges of the canals in Amsterdam. And these bridges are really famous for its little light bulbs that are in this half arch shape that then get reflected in the water of the canal.
We take a look inside One World's first dedicated lounge in Europe. Stay with us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It is 8:23 a.m. here in Zurich, 7:23 a.m. in London, which is where we head next for our first instalment of today's paper review, courtesy of the journalist and geopolitics expert Latika Burke. A very good morning to you. How's London looking, Latika?
Emma, good morning. First time I've been in the studio at Monocle this year where the sun has actually been up. OK, slight exaggeration. It's daylight. The sun's not yet out itself.
Okay, good to hear. And the big question is are you sitting in the presenter's chair?
No, Emma, I could never do that to you.
What a shame. I was hoping you'd make a land grab. Letika, what have you spotted in the papers today?
Look, a really interesting story in Japan Times that's on the front page there, because Japan, the United States, Australia and the Philippines held their first ever naval and air drills together in the South China Sea on the weekend. So this is a pretty big deal, Emma. You've heard a lot about a Quad operating in this region that normally involves India, but in this case, it's the Philippines. And of course, that's very strategic in itself, because many think that the Philippines, in fact, and not so much Taiwan, is actually the front line of whatever flashpoint might happen between China and a fellow Asian neighbour, testing, of course, what the United States and its allies would do. Well, that's a show of force, and it was intended to be a deterrent, according to Rahm Emanuel, the United States ambassador in Tokyo, who is never shy of a colourful phrase, Emma.
Indeed. What was said?
Well, he has put some photographs up on Twitter saying exactly that this is meant to be a deterrent. Now, the language officially carried in this newspaper report that quotes the defense agencies, of course, from all the four countries is a lot more calm than that. It says simply restating the positions of the countries that they oppose any unilateral changes to status quo by force. And this includes attempts and actions that seek to increase tensions in the South China Sea. Now, if you closed your eyes and imagined someone in Beijing saying that, you could almost let that pass. So, of course, both sides here are claiming something. Now, the South China Sea is disputed, but there was a 2016 ruling that says much of what China is claiming in the South China Sea, specifically an area relating to the Second Thomas Shoal around the Philippines, is not in China's domain. So this is going to be a flashpoint you and I, Emma, will be discussing a lot more. But this is a pretty significant deal, this quadrilateral exercise that took place on the weekend.
What they are dealing with, though, and I think this is quite neatly summed up in the article in the Japan Times, it says Beijing maintains a claim to 90% of the South China Sea, despite the fact that there are claims by the likes of Taiwan, Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, Indonesia and the Philippines, who all say that it belongs to them. And 90% is an enormous figure.
It's huge. And Beijing has been showing itself very willing to be muscular in this region. They have been using water cannons, for example, against the Philippine Coast Guard, when it tries to refuel and replenish its supplies and its personnel on board the Second Thomas Shoal, which is a rusting ship parked on a bit of reef that the Philippines says it's China claims it and was ruled against in 2016 in The Hague. So this is a very, very tense area and a very tense region. And yes, China is going to absolutely say it's the big dog in this region. It very clearly says the United States has no business being in the South China Sea. Of course, the United States does not believe that. And we are going to see some pretty high-level visits this week, and we expect President Biden to once again warn China specifically on the Philippines. And again, just stressing there, Emma, we've heard so much about Taiwan over the last few years. There's a lot of focus on what China might or might not do when it comes to Taiwan. There's a lot less focus on what China might or might not do when it comes to the Philippines. But arguably, there are a lot of people who think that's actually the more significant hotspot to watch right now.
Let's head to Poland and an article in the Financial Times, which highlights the sort of the power struggles inside Poland, which have emerged since Donald Tusk became prime minister and effectively pushed the opposition out, but it's had the opposite effect, hasn't it?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I've been watching this story for quite some time because I know some journalists at TVP, which is a Polish TV station. It's state media, and it was under the PIS party piece. It was heavily pro-government, of course, and heavily right-wing. Now, when Donald Tusk won the recent election, he closed down this television station for about a week or so, and it led to an enormous power struggle. Now, the television station is back on air. There are much fewer PIS-leaning staff spouting such views on television. It's become quite an ordinary, run-of-the-mill TV and news station. What has since happened, though, is that this has simply amplified and given greater viewership and ratings to the existing and established but not state-run conservative media. And think here the equivalent of, say, Fox News or GB News. And they themselves staff at these stations use these television stations as their role models or their examples of what they're trying to emulate. And the FT's done a very good story here where they visited TV Republica, for example, which is one of these stations that sees itself as a bit of a Fox News lookalike in Poland. And it is simply making the point here that in actually what doing what Tusk has done, he has inadvertently emboldened and strengthened the rival television stations that are spouting the exact views he didn't want heard, at least not on state media. Now, you could say, of course, well, that's the natural way of the land. That's the media market. And commercial media has every right to say and believe what they want and state media doesn't because it's taxpayer funds. But it is just an illustrative example there of what sometimes what looks like on paper a good move when you come into office can actually have the exact opposite effect.
Let's have a look now at an article in The Guardian, which details a report that examines the UK's Foreign Office. And the words describing the Foreign Office is elitist and rooted in the past.
Well, I never. Emma, is this a shock to you?
Look, this depends.
This is quite a surprising report. And I picked this out because it was written by Lord Sedwill, Mark Sedwill, who was former National Security Advisor. Now, he is one of the authors of this report. And he is arguing that the UK is not making the transition to being a middle power well enough, and it needs a giant overhaul in the Foreign Office so it can better integrate things like climate change and trade, for example. Now, it uses models like Australia to say this is what we should be doing more of. But really, it is quite a very scathing view of how the Foreign Office is operating, and in particular makes a lot of reference to colonisation and demand from former colonies for reparations and some compensation for historical emissions. And of course, that's a battle I know, Emma, you follow very closely on Monocle, this battle between the Global South and the rest, who argue that they've had a bit of a difficult time trying to adapt to a world that the West has had a lot more time and got to pollute the world essentially for free, and now it's being asked to shoulder such a burden on climate change. So a lot of these issues aren't exactly new, but I think that the timing of this report, and Patrick Winter, The Guardian's diplomatic editor, writes this is clearly intended to be directed at the next Labour government, giving them the chance to perhaps come in, sweep through the Foreign Office and go on a giant overhaul. We'll see if that happens, Emma.
Latika Book, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson, coming to you live from Dufourstrasse 90 in Zurich, where the time is 8:32 a.m. Let's have a look at some of today's headlines. Palestinians have begun to return to the southern Gazan city of Khan Yunis after Israel says it reduced the number of soldiers operating in the region. The move leaves just one brigade there. Meanwhile, Israel and Hamas said they'd sent delegations to Cairo to take part in ceasefire negotiations. And Iraq says it'll send 10 million litres of fuel to the Gaza Strip to aid Palestinians. Iraq has also said it's prepared to receive and treat wounded Palestinians injured in the conflict in Gaza. The head of the IAEA has condemned a drone strike on the Russian-controlled Zaporizhia power plant in Ukraine. Reports suggest a building containing a reactor was damaged, but no risk was posed. The Polish opposition party Law and Justice has come first in the country's local elections. It's a setback for the Prime Minister Donald Tusk, who had been hoping to cement his political comeback. And for the first time, French soldiers will conduct a changing of the guard outside Buckingham Palace in London today, with British soldiers doing the same duties in Paris. The move is part of a celebration of 120 years since the signing of the Entente Cordiale. Signed in 1904, the Entente Cordiale cemented an improvement in relations between the two countries after the Napoleonic Wars. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Now, the tech giant Microsoft has issued a warning that forthcoming elections in the US, South Korea and India could be disrupted by China using artificial intelligence. The US tech firm said it expected Chinese state-backed cyber groups to target high-profile elections this year, with North Korea also involved. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined now from our studio in London by Ali Bohani, a strategic expert who was formerly based in Dubai and managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Ali's also co-host of BRI Dialogues. Very good morning to you, Ali.
Good morning, Emma.
Welcome to Midori House. So what is it that Microsoft is saying that China could do?
Well, I think there is a great concern with the power of AI at, you know, states will start dabbling into one another's electoral process and democracies. But one has to realize that, you know, AI is at the moment unregulated. You know, we're getting into large language models, but large legal models are missing. And at the same time, I think U.S. is somehow forgetting that a lot of discourse goes back to the Florida Bush and, you know, Gore era. The erosion of public trust, you know, in electoral process in the United States is something that is the story must be tackled at home. You will see that, you know, with deep fake, with cryptocurrencies, and the fact that in U.S. at the moment everybody's holding their breath as to where Taylor Swift will lay in and weigh in is saying a lot.
Exactly. So just to explain to us what exactly what the disruption by China actually looks like. How would we spot it, or how would it manifest itself?
It would be very hard, Emma, to be honest with you, because finger-pointing is easy. But with technology, many times there are as well, you know, you see in these tools that a state can implicate a third state. So it's a very risky proposition to come out and just to outsource all of it in advance to China. Do United States and China and great powers interfere in each other's affairs? They do. I mean, there's this famous quote that diplomacy is telling somebody to go to hell in a way that, you know, that person actually looks forward to the trip. And I think the fact that the United States would like to say, hey, if anything goes wrong, it's with China, overlooks the complexities of the private capital in the United States. You have many opinionated deep pockets, you know, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, all of them have their own political convictions and preferences. And AI is unregulated. A lot of it's happening in dark kitchens. And as a matter of fact, in China, you know, technology and AI is strictly overseen and, you know, looked after by the state. In the United States, you have private sector, so it is very easy to point fingers. But at the same time, I think we need a deeper conversation between China and United States as peer competitors, similar to nuclear treaty, because containment, collaboration and code of conduct are not all, you know, part of the same dish that U.S. can serve. The United States at the moment wants to have an a la carte collaboration with China, but a buffer criticism. And China doesn't work that way. If you look at Kissinger, you look at the diplomacy of 60s and 70s, they have to sit down. They have to talk about a structured treaty in and around AI. Otherwise, we're really, you know, running into shifting sands.
Surely this is too late now when we have reports that China attempted an AI-generated disinformation campaign in Taiwan, and now we have the likes of Microsoft stepping up. I mean, sitting down and talking across the table is one thing, but doing something and preventing any interference in elections is a different matter altogether.
Completely, and I couldn't agree more there with you, but one who is familiar with China knows that you need candid, private, respectful, secure conversations. The only thing that at the moment is taking place, if you look at FT's cover today, is that U.S. is warning China on this front, U.S. is warning China on that front. Janet Yellen is giving stern warnings to China on this subject. Chinese need to sit down and talk to Americans. And likewise, the stakes are high for humanity. It's not just about this election, you know. You look at deep fakes and you look at cryptocurrency role in the U.S. election and upcoming elections. There is much more at stake, I think, than just saying, oh, we found, you know, an attempt by Microsoft. Because some of it surfaces, we hear about them. There's a lot more behind the scenes between Beijing and Washington. And they need to sit down and, as I said, have, you know, peer-competitor conversations and have a framework around AI. This is just the beginning. Because think about it, Emma. They're talking about Neuralink. They're talking about brain-computer interface. 12 years ago, 15 years ago, if we were talking about many of these technologies, one would have said, what are you smoking? Are you crazy? These things will come as well. So the question is, if we're not putting the guardrails and having proper conversations state to state about rules of engagement and having the framework in which we do not interfere in each other's affairs and but at the same time respecting each other's processes in terms of model of governance, those conversations have to take place right now. As I said, the deep pocket, I would say dark kitchens of AI are much more sprouting in the Western Hemisphere. And we have to be very mindful because the private capital in our part of the world at the moment trumps the state's investment, R&D, and control in, you know, AI and artificial intelligence. And as I said, large language models need large legal models around them as well.
Ali Bohani, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Globalist. Now, following the completion of the Global Airline Alliance's One World first dedicated lounge in Seoul, last month we saw the unveiling of a lounge at Amsterdam Schiphol Airport. It's the Alliance's first in Europe. So Monocle Radio sent writer and broadcaster Jeannie Tan to the busy grand opening, where she heard from Joachim Stratmann, he's art director at DDoG, and they created the visual look and feel for the lounge. Jeannie began by asking Joachim about the brief he was given at the start of the project.
In the beginning, when we got in contact with One World, we got the brand documents that they have developed with Ogilvy, the brand agency. And these documents were very specially about brand identity, about how to publish things. Having also catchy imagery of how the guest experience would be and could be. And that's what we took in first. They were very colorful, they were very exciting and playful as well, very catchy. But the colors, the One World colors, as you know, are very strong pastel colors. So when we had the mission to basically translate that in a 3D spatial concept, to really start to design actual space with, that was kind of a challenge. Like, how are we going to translate all these colors? How do we get these nice props that you see on these photos? How do you get that feeling of levity and brightness into the space? And then it started to develop in, let's look at this One World blue and translate that into the seating landscape. So the seating landscape has these tones of blue that are very comforting, that are soothing, that put you in ease, but they also have an allure. They have their sophistication in terms of the materials, the mohair wool that we use, of course all materials suitable for airports.
And the Dutch touches, let's move on to them.
Yeah, so apart from being very recognizable, we wanted to introduce these local flavors to the design, and we were inspired, for example, by the bridges of the canals in Amsterdam. And these bridges are really famous for its little light bulbs that are in this half arch shape that then get reflected in the water of the canal. So you get this full circle that you magically pass through with these boats on the canals, right? So this feeling was a very nice metaphor for entering the lounge through this portal with light bulbs and arches that basically forms a transition from the airport bus into this branded environment. And good really give this kind of touch of glamour and cheerful way of entering this branded environment.
And
The Dutch skies. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Dutch skies are full of birds as well. That's why we also have birds on top of the bar. We have one bird even popping a chewing gum. So it's a very cute little detail. When you sit at the bar, you look up, you see that. But indeed, this lounge is an amazing panorama of sky. So it's the tarmac with a lot of gates and very wide airfield, but also the skies that in Holland always change. Now it's really grey, but we have a lot of different cloud formations that are famous by centuries of painting. The famous cloud painters in the Golden Age, as we call it, are known for these beautiful clouds.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of this type of view, is this very normal for an airport lounge? Is it a rarity?
Yeah, I believe that the kind of classic thing that an airport lounge wants to have is, of course, the tarmac view and the contact with the nostalgia of flying and going somewhere else, right? Exploring. So this is something that a lot of lounges would like to have, but it's not always the case, and not always in this amount of splendor. So I think that this place on Schiphol is really very special in terms of a huge panoramic window. What is also nice is the space is not so deep, so the space forms itself along this long window. It's not a small window in the end, but no, it's really the whole facade of the lounge that has this quality.
Mm-hmm. And if we just quickly circle back to the brief from the client, how did they want to set themselves apart from competitors with this new lounge and this new, you know, collection of lounges?
Yeah, it has to do with the services offered, but it also really has to do with this translation of Travel Bright, which really led to new color schemes, new way of designing colorful light into the space rather than just put branding colors everywhere. And I found it a very daring document where they started with in terms of branding, to really brand yourself in this whole conglomerate of airline members with such strong colors, very pronounced. So that was the challenge, but it's also really the unique point of these spaces. And what I also got as a feedback, that the airlines are very happy with this kind of language as well.
And that's Monocle's Jeannie Tan speaking to Joachim Stratman. You're listening to The Globalist live on Monocle Radio.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 8:47 in Zurich, and today on The Globalist we bring you not one but two paper reviews, ladies and gentlemen. Aren't you lucky? Because Noelle Salmi is joining me. She's a travel culture writer based in Zurich. She's brought along a stack of good stories to tell us. A very good morning to you, Noelle. How is Zurich this morning?
Pretty good. It's incredibly warm, actually.
Yep, shoulders are out, ladies and gentlemen. The interesting thing is that everybody's talking about the Sahara sand, and so are the papers. And I have seen none of this. I mean, since my arrival on Saturday afternoon, it has been the non-stop chatter among those in the know, and yet no sign of the Sahara sand that's supposed to descend from the skies.
Well, if you take a walk and take a good look at the mountains, you might notice that they are actually hazier than normal. So this Sahara sand is brought on a wind called the Föhn. Föhn, interestingly, is also the German word for hairdryer, because it refers to a hot, dry wind. And this hot, dry wind is what is bringing this warm weather. And it's also bringing particles of sand from the Sahara northwards, over the Alps and into Switzerland. And today is supposed to be even more than yesterday, so maybe you'll catch it today. If you have respiratory conditions or asthma, don't go out for a run because that might be less healthy. But you can take some photos and send them into 20 minutes. One of the local papers is asking for photos. And I've been skiing when the Sahara Sands has turned the snow yellow and the sky yellow as well. So it's pretty cool. So take a look, and there will be a good sunset as well.
Okay, you have been warned. Zurich is orange today, or yellow. let's have a look at, there's an article in Le Temps, isn't there, about France wanting Switzerland to help pay for building its nuclear power plants. The Swiss haven't taken this very kindly, have they?
No, they have not. Yes, so as you know, French President Emmanuel Macron has been saying that he wants to build up France is already pretty formidable collection of nuclear power plants. He wants to build 6 more and possibly as many as 14 by 2050. And that will cost 100 billion euros. And he would like to have Switzerland help pay for it because Switzerland imports energy, nuclearly produced energy from France. And this is not actually without precedent. In the 1970s, the residents of Kaiseraugst opposed the creation of a nuclear power plant in their region. So Swiss electricity providers back then helped finance the construction of plants in France with the aim of being guaranteed the right to purchase some of the electricity that they produced. But nuclear power is becoming even less popular in Switzerland. And so the big energy companies now are saying that they would prefer to invest in other renewable energy sources.
Indeed, like so many other places, it was Fukushima which changed Switzerland's policy when it comes to nuclear power, didn't it?
That's right. That's exactly right. And that is what the newspapers are saying.
Okay, lovely. Thank you very much indeed for that. Let's move on to another story about Swiss merchants want to stop people using Chinese shopping apps. I mean, how popular is the average Chinese shopping app here in Zurich?
Well, it turns out it's pretty popular. Imports from abroad, according to the post office, are up 10%, and there's basically from China. Well, you have now spent a fair amount of time here, Emma, and you know that pretty much everything in Switzerland is expensive. So it gets pretty tempting to get onto a site like Temu or Shein and go ahead and import those things. But both Swiss regulators and Swiss merchants associations are saying this stuff is really low quality. It doesn't meet Swiss or EU standards. Clothing can be carcinogenic. They tested a bunch of baby toys, and it turns out practically all of them were non-compliant. Electrical products were non-compliant. The question is, how can they regulate those things coming in?
Indeed, it would be a very, very clever country that could stop this from happening.
Yes, it would be. Yeah, no, it's... customs officials are pretty strict in Switzerland, but it's so much stuff is coming in that they said that their customs officers are overwhelmed.
Now, tell us a little bit more about a story in the NZZ about chocolate the global competition for the chocolate market, something which obviously the Swiss have a keen eye on. But this is a story in the NZZ about chocolate coming from Africa.
That's right. Yes, well, you're right. The Swiss have a keen eye on it, not only because they produce some of the world's best chocolate, they also eat the most of it annually of anyone else. And so typically, Ivory Coast produces 45% of the world's cocoa beans, but they don't, until now, they haven't produced any chocolate. That means that they only get 7% of the profits from those cocoa beans. But now there's a startup called Cocayans, which is the brainchild of Julien Marbouf. He was the Ivory Coast country manager for a Swiss-based coffee trader, and Alain Porquet, who was an Ivorian diplomat. And they have a twofold plan. One is to produce the coffee more naturally. They are using a method that takes out the bitterness during fermentation. And more importantly, they want to produce the coffee in the Ivory Coast. I need more coffee. They want to produce the chocolate in the Ivory Coast. And they've already produced 2 tons of it last year at a cafe and a small hotel that's owned by Porquet. They have a chocolatier who is a Parisian trained but Ivorian. And the trick is now how they're going to export it.
Noel, thank you so much for joining us around the table here at Dufourstrasse 90. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, let's talk architecture and design. Tim Abrams joins us on the line from London. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And delighted to hear that the venues for the Olympic Games are now ready. I mean, that sounds like a big statement, but really it's actually quite a modest project, isn't it?
There is only one new venue for the Olympic Games in Paris. The Athletes' Village is also a new set of structures, but this is the one new venue and it's been completed, so we're ready to go, except not quite.
Oh, right. OK, so tell us all about this venue and why are we not quite ready there yet?
Effectively, there's one. The one new venue is a swimming pool. It's not actually going to be where the Olympics host the swimming. It's going to be where the diving and the synchronized swimming are going to take place. But after that, it's going to be a community pool right on the edge of Paris, on the border with Paris and Saint-Denis. So it's effectively, if you imagine it, as a very large, beautiful community facility, which is being dressed up and delivered as an Olympic facility, then you get some idea of where Paris is going with it, way it's organizing its venues. It's very much about taking existing facilities, largely, apart from this one new one, and bigging them up, dressing them up, refurbishing them, creating temporary structures, and hosting the Olympics in that way.
And there is always that perpetual tension between the residents of a city and the organisers of an Olympic Games. I mean, are Parisians coming round to the idea of the Olympics being there, especially if they have existing facilities being given an upgrade?
The way in which Parisians deal with large-scale events which bring in tourists may be something we need to ask Parisians on an individual level. But I think the way in which the city has gone about approaching the Games has left a lot of people with a positive impression. And the level of disturbance is pretty minimal given some of the other moves that are happening in the city, particularly the introduction of 15 mini cities by their mayor Anne Hidalgo. So the Paris Olympics is pretty minor in comparison to the inconveniences that previous moves in the city have caused.
Tim, let's talk about Salone del Mobile. There's an awful lot of chatter here in Zurich because I know that Monaco is dispatching a considerable contingent to Milan in the next couple of weeks. Tell us what the latest from Salone is.
The Salone perhaps, shall we say, at the end of a very, very positive period for the Italian and European wider furniture industry. The lockdown following the COVID pandemic was very good for business. People were buying things, making their homes look nice, making their outdoor furnishings look nice. What is currently happening is there is a period of slowdown as the market in China, which is obviously in furniture, as in many other things, one of the most growth developing areas, and there's a slowdown there. There are also supply side issues due to the events in Ukraine and the inflation ensuing therefrom. So we're at the end of a positive period, and it looks as if the Salone is scaling down its event. Large numbers of previously supportive brands are not actually turning up to the big fair out in the outskirts of Milan itself and are actually focusing on their retail spaces, smaller, intimate spaces in the centre of the city. So there will still be plenty of things to go and see. And indeed, the way in which the Italians are dealing with the downscaling is by designing it out. There's some really interesting images coming out of the Salone as different designers are kind of rationalizing the lack of exhibitors.
Tim Abrams, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle Radio. And that's all the time we have for today's programme. The warmest of thanks to all my guests and to our live audience here at Dufourstrasse 90. And thanks too to the producers in London, Vincent McAvinney, Tom Webb and Monica Lillis. Our research with George Ruskin and our studio manager Lily Austin in London. Our studio manager here in Zurich, Vati Sok. After the headlines, more music on the way. The briefing's live at midday back in London, but The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. For now, from me, Emma Nelson. Goodbye. Thank you very much for listening and have a great week.